From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. It's become a sort of modern refrain. You hear this from people all the time. I have ADD. I don't think they mean, in many cases, I don't think they mean that they actually have a diagnosis, but they, you know, we often just feel completely attentionally challenged, pulled in a million directions because of technology, the pace of modern life, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, some of us do actually have ADHD or ADD diagnosed or undiagnosed, including several people in my life. So what do you do if you have this condition? Well, we've got an incredible expert who has suffered with it herself and treats people who are dealing with it and can talk about attentional issues as well for the rest of us. Stephanie Sarkis is her name, and you're going to hear a lot from her coming up. First, though, one item of business and then your voicemails. So the business, I have spent much of the last few hours toggling back and forth between absorbing Kanye West's new album and watching the amazing new videos for the new course on the 10% Happier app. We've got this new course up. It's, in my opinion, one of, if not the best courses we've ever done. It takes all of these never-before-seen, behind-the-scenes moments from the meditation tour that Jeff Warren and I did not long ago, where we crossed the country in a big, silly bus and met all sorts of wannabe meditators and talked to them about their challenges. And it takes all of this great behind-the-scenes footage that we've never released and also pairs it with incredibly useful teaching on all sorts of issues, from how to establish healthy habits, which is a huge problem for people who are dealing with, you know, who want to set up a meditation habit, for finding time in your life to meditate, if you're a new parent, creativity, dealing with the stress of being overly scheduled, busyness. And also, there are some really intimate and somewhat embarrassing moments where I talk about some of my own inner demons. I'm just really proud of the team who put this together. I love this course. It's really great. And you can find it on the 10% Happier app if you're a subscriber. And if you're not, well, think about it. All right, that's the business. On now to voicemails. And before we do the voicemails, here's my usual caveat, which is that I am not a meditation teacher, nor am I a mental health professional, nor have I heard these voicemails in advance. So I just do my best to answer as a journalist and fellow rank-and-file meditator. So here we go. Here's voicemail number one.
Hi, Dan. This is Ellen calling from Los Angeles. Thanks so much for the work that you do. I recently started meditating and have found your podcast and all of your conversations with guests so enlightening. My question is, in your experience with battling depression or anxiety, if you have found the process of cognitive behavioral therapy helpful, how do you balance going through your day and identifying when to just note and be mindful of the thoughts that are going through your head versus using CBT and really taking the time to stop and analyze those thoughts and challenge the negative assumptions behind them? Thanks so much. Bye.
So cognitive behavioral therapy, for those who, for the uninitiated, is a type of, I think I'm saying this correctly, it's a type of psychotherapy, a type of mental health treatment. I have not really done it, so I'm not really well equipped to talk about it in detail. But I think I can, generally speaking, answer your question, which is, if I think I'm going to try to restate it, and hopefully I'm doing so correctly. What is the, you know, in a meditation practice, you are noting your thoughts non-judgmentally and letting them go. So you might note, you might have a flurry of self-judgment. I have a lot of that in my practice. You know, you suck at this. How come you can't stay with the breath? Why are you so sleepy? Blah, blah, blah. And so you might note it as judgment and then let it go. That's generally how meditation practice is taught. In CBT and in traditional therapy, you're encouraged to really analyze the thoughts, which is a, you know, I think a sort of very much related to mindfulness, and it can be powered by mindfulness, but it also employs a part of the brain that in meditation we're not emphasizing so much, which is analysis. In meditation, we're emphasizing, at least as in my experience, we're emphasizing just sort of the raw data of your senses, as opposed to getting stuck in and even that term I just said, getting stuck in your thinking processes. So I actually think the answer for me, walking around in my daily life when I'm off the cushion, so to speak, is not that complicated, which is, you know, in actual meditation, I'm probably not going to do a lot of analyzing of the type of thinking I'm doing. Maybe I will. Maybe if something, you know, a really seemingly useful insight has arisen about the quality and frequency of my thought patterns, maybe I will analyze it. But generally speaking, I'm, you know, my training is I just note that I'm thinking, maybe note the kind of thinking, judging, anger, whatever, and then let it go and go back to my breath or whatever it is my primary object of meditation. But off the cushion, I think actually the analysis is very helpful. And this is where meditation can be, you know, can lead you to be a better human being, to be much nicer to yourself and to others, which is that you can notice if you're just walking around that you have this habitual pattern, say, of judging people based on how they look. That's a big one. Judging people on their skin color, on your guesses about their socioeconomic status, on their gender. And that's just an interesting thing to notice. And I think cognitive, you know, analysis about why you're thinking these ways can sort of decouple you from your unconscious biases and unconscious in the kind of stories you're habitually telling yourself. So I think that's a long, perhaps unskillful way of saying, to me, I don't see a conflict, and it can be a little, I can imagine where it'll get confusing in terms of how to deal with your thinking processes during meditation. But when you're not meditating and you're just trying to be as mindful as possible in the rest of your life, I actually think that's a great time to bring to bear some of the skills that we learn in either traditional therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. So there may be mental health experts out there who are screaming at their at me right now because I've messed up that answer. But I think I've given you the right answer. But somebody else should leave me a voicemail and tell me if I've screwed up. Okay, voicemail number two.
Hey, Dan, big fan. You and Sam Harris, your brother from another mother, were the primary influences for me to start in meditation practice a couple years back. And now 2.5 years later, I have a regular daily practice. So thanks for that. Two somewhat related questions. First, when you speak about mindfulness meditation, you tend to describe it as focusing on the breath. And then when you get distracted, just noticing and coming back to the breath. It seems to me, based on my reading of Buddhism and mindfulness meditation, that's almost more of a concentration practice that you're describing than a mindfulness practice. I'm wondering if you could speak a little about the kind of next step in mindfulness practice, maybe kind of expanding your awareness to notice whatever you're experiencing and not just the breath and coming back to it. Second question, I'm curious in your study of Buddhism if you've come across a practice called Cittanupassana. I know you advocate for mindfulness meditation, which is a direct derivative of Vipassana practice, but I've come across, and some teachers have recommended to me, a Cittanupassana practice, which I think is something along the lines of awareness of awareness itself, which is extremely confusing. So just curious if you know about that and if you could speak to that and the differences between that and Vipassana. Thanks again.
Okay. Well, there's a lot there. So on the first question, yes, when I talk about the meditation for beginners, I really try to whittle it down to its basics, which is sit with your eyes closed. If you don't want to have your eyes closed, you can keep them open a little bit if you want. And try to bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. And then when you get distracted, start again and again and again and again, because you will get distracted a million times. And that's not a problem or a failure. That is just the nature of the mind. And the whole game of meditation is to notice when you become distracted and start again. And why is that a victory rather than a failure? It's a victory because when you see how crazy you are less likely to be owned by it. You are correct when you say that when I describe the basic instructions for meditation, it can come off as just a concentration practice by which you are training mostly your ability to stay on task, which is to stay with your breath. The repeated exercise of trying to focus on one thing at a time, getting lost, starting again, boosts your ability to concentrate. But there is, and again, I know I do this a lot of sort of apologizing for my lack of experience, and I want to do it again because I can only speak from, I am not, as I've said a million times, a meditation teacher. I can only sort of regurgitate to the best of my memory what I've been taught. But there is a lot of mindfulness in that, it's in the moment that you see you've become distracted. You see what's distracted you and you let it go. And by let it go, I mean you don't get sucked up into it, or you actually may notice you've already been sucked up into whatever story you're telling yourself in that moment, or whatever pain in your body you're feeling, and then the stories you're telling about the pain in the body. But seeing all of that, seeing how the mind works in those moments, that you are sucked up into a story and it feels a certain way, just seeing that can create the other big skill of meditation. So there's concentration, and then there's mindfulness. And mindfulness is the skill of knowing what's happening in your mind right now without getting carried away by it. And so even in those basic instructions, there is this other skill of mindfulness. But then, of course, very quickly even in an early meditation practice, you move beyond the basic instructions as I often recount them. And bear in mind, the reason why I recount them the way I do is just because I'm often talking I'm trying to rapidly describe the practice to large groups of uninitiated people. So that's why I talk about it the way I do. But the other move that a lot of meditation teachers will tell you to do in an early practice is if you're getting distracted, when you're getting distracted by something persistent, like a powerful emotion or a feeling in your body of restlessness or discomfort, then the move is to turn into that, to make that the object, that's the technical term. The other way to say it is the focus of your meditation. Meditate on that. So say it's a pain in your knee. You might just turn instead of focusing on your breath, which may be difficult if you've got a really strong pain in your knee, bring your full attention to the feeling of that pain in your knee. And there's a lot to be learned there that can build your mindfulness muscles. You will see that the pain is constantly shifting and moving. The lesson of that is that everything is impermanent. Nothing is solid and everlasting. You will also see that the mind tells all sorts of stories about the pain in your knee. My God, this is just going to get worse, and I'm never going to be able to do this, and I'm actually never going to be able to meditate. Therefore, I'm never going to get the mental skills that I need in order to succeed, and then I'm going to live under a bridge. So that's a mental process known as prapancha, which is this sort of movie making we do that usually ends up in a very horrific ending. All of this is, again, just falls under the category of mindfulness, which is, again, just the skill of knowing what's happening in your mind without getting carried away by it, being able to see your various mental processes without being owned by them, without necessarily taking the bait and acting on them. Just because you experience anger doesn't mean you need to act on it. I think it's a great question, and I hope I've made clear why I generally describe the beginning instructions the way I do. But I think, A, there's a lot of mindfulness baked right into them, properly understood, and B, there are simple moves one can make that are not, you know, dramatic variations of those basic instructions that will really take it from a pure concentration practice to a pure mindfulness practice. But I think also one thing, last thing to say, is that it's important. It's hard to do much mindfulness if you have no concentration. So it's important in the early days of meditating to really build your some mental stability so that you get a sense of what's going on in your head with some clarity. And then that allows you to break it down and see how it's changing and see how it produces this sort of proliferating thought process and all of the things that we do under mindfulness, which is a kind of self-awareness that really can change the way you relate to the world. The second question I can give a short answer to, because I've never heard of that term. I did briefly while you were, what was the term again? It was Chittanupassana, which definitely sounds like a Buddhist term. I had never heard it before. I quickly did a rapid Google while you were talking. It's translated as contemplation on the mind. So I can say a little bit about contemplation of the mind. I don't know how well I'm going to state this because I've never really talked about it before, but much of what we do in meditation is we're paying attention to objects, what we call objects in meditation. So usually one very common object is the breath, but also we can pay attention to objects like emotions and physical sensations. So that's generally the pose we're in meditation. We're looking at something. And in that, there's a kind of duality. It's us looking at something. A very interesting move to make in meditation is to turn the lens around and look at what is the mind that is knowing these things. So one exercise that my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, often recommends, which I found to be incredibly useful and interesting, is close your eyes and listen to all the sounds that are available to you, that are audible to you right now. And then ask yourself, what is hearing? Where is the quote-unquote me who's hearing everything? And you won't find anything because there's nothing to find. And that not finding is a really interesting and healthy process, so the argument goes, and I found it to be very much so. You are bumping up against a fundamental mystery of the universe, which is the mystery of consciousness. We know that the lights are on for us. We know that we're aware of whatever we're aware of right now, the hearing my voice or seeing whatever's in front of you if you have sight. Feeling your body in whatever position it happens to be in right now. We know that we are receiving data from our various senses. What we don't know is, and what scientists have never been able to figure out, is who or what is knowing it. And that is, so that for me, the contemplation of the mind is an incredibly interesting thing on many levels. And one of the other things it does, aside from being interesting intellectually, is that it can, over time, sort of break down this sense of solidity we have around ourselves. And this fiction, really, on one level, this fiction of the self, you know, on one level, of course, we have a self. We have to put our pants on in the morning and make dentist appointments, et cetera, et cetera. But on some deeper level, there isn't really a solid self in there. And seeing that fiction can sort of get you to declench a little bit, because that fiction of that there is some you in there that you need to defend and protect all the time can help you live with a little bit more ease. Man, good questions this week, and I really hope I didn't screw them up. If you want to call and ask me other questions that I struggle to answer, you should. The number is available in the show notes of this podcast, so you can just poke around a little bit in there, and there's a phone number. Call, leave me voicemails, and leave me a message, ask me a question, or tell me how badly I've screwed up the answers to the foregoing questions. All right. Thank you very much for that, guys. Really appreciate it. Let's get to this week's guest, Stephanie Sarkis. I really enjoyed this. We did it, actually. This is one of the rare ones where we did it remotely. She is she's based in Florida, and she called in. We don't usually do that, but I really wanted to have her on the show. And Stephanie is a specialist in the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, or ADD, as it's sometimes called. She's written a bunch of books on it. She also treats children, adolescents, and grown-ups with the condition. She writes for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post. She also works with patients with anxiety and autism. So she's got a lot to say, and a lot to say about how meditation has helped her with attention issues, and how it might help you, whether you have full-blown ADHD or just, like the rest of us, struggle to stay focused on any one thing at a time. So here she is, Stephanie Sarkis. So here's my traditional first question. How did you get into meditation?
I was doing research on non-medication treatments for ADHD and saw the data showed it really helped with ADHD. So then I started recommending it to my clients, and then I started doing it because I have ADHD. And it's helped pretty much everybody that I've worked with. So pretty powerful stuff. And I usually do more mindfulness stuff because people with ADHD, you know, like you can meditate while you're doing things, and it seems to be a little more ADHD friendly.
Say more about that, because people listening may not know too much about sort of different kinds of meditation.
Okay, so mindfulness meditation, you're meditating while you're doing things. For instance, eating mindfulness practice is you just sit and focus on your food. You don't do anything else. You turn off the TV, you don't look at your phone, you don't read the paper. You just focus on your food and you chew your food. It's usually about 20 bites per chew, but for people I work with ADHD, I do more like 10 or 15 chews. People have found that they are eating less food and still feeling satiated or full. They're also gravitating towards healthier proteins and fresh fruits and fresh vegetables. Because when you're just focusing on your food, sometimes people realize the food they're eating they don't even really like. So they start changing up what they're eating and they start eating healthier. So it's pretty powerful.
Huge problem for me. I mean, I've been meditating for a minute, you know, for a while, and I mindlessly eat all the time. But anyway, we'll talk about that later because I want to stay on you for a second. Just in terms of mindfulness meditation, you can do it while you're doing things. You can do anything mindfully, but you can also do it in a seated, formal, eyes closed practice, which I imagine you were also doing.
Right. Yeah. It's very versatile like that. You can do it in any type of format. It's basically just focusing on the breath, inhale and exhale.
And then when you get lost, which you will a million times, start over.
Right. Right. You just let the thoughts pass and then you keep going.
So how long ago did you start doing it?
I would say probably about 10, 15 years ago. I started doing it and started looking at it as a treatment for people with ADHD and also depression, anxiety. And the research for ADHD came out probably about the last 5 years or so. A lot of data accumulating about the effectiveness of it. So, and it's one of those things that's got a real high return on investment. You know, you take just 5-10 minutes out of your day and you can get beneficial effects. In fact, even changing your brain structure and your brain chemistry just by meditating.
So tell me about the effect on you. Well, let me start by just pulling back for a second. Define ADHD.
Sure. ADHD is an issue with inhibition of behavior and also motivation. So in your frontal lobes of your brain, you have the executive functions, and those are things like organizing, thinking ahead, planning, cognitive flexibility, in other words, changing up what you're doing, and also hyperfocus can be an issue with ADHD. So when you have ADHD, your executive functions are impaired. So you have difficulty with staying organized, you have difficulty with impulsive decision making, maybe spending too much money. You have issues with being so focused that somebody will call your name, you don't even realize what's going on. So that's what it looks like when you have ADHD. So that's the frontal lobe dysfunction.
And so you had been dealing with this your whole life?
Yes.
And what flavor of it? Because you said there are a lot of ways it can manifest.
Sure. Yeah, I have the combined type. So the inattentive type is more forgetfulness, losing items, difficulty with getting motivated. The hyperactive impulsive type is interrupting. It's feeling like you have to be on the go all the time. Like you don't have an inner kind of calm And so what I have is the type that you have both. So the combined type, inattentive and hyperactive impulsive.
Two great tastes that taste great together, I would imagine.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot
I
of fun.
I can only imagine. So what, how did it show up for you? How disruptive was it in your life? Because you're a big time, you know, author and therapist, so it couldn't have messed you up too badly, right?
Well, first, my mom was a special ed teacher. My dad was an attorney, so I was behavior modified from a really early age, and I could not argue for a later curfew. So I think my parents gave me enough structure, but also gave me a little bit of freedom. So I think that kept me on track for a while. When I noticed that I was thinking differently than other people's when I got to college. So my friends would sit there and study for 3 hours straight, and I had no idea how they were doing this. I was wandering around the library. You know, I memorized all the stacks of books. In graduate school, I took classes I really enjoyed, but I could not sit through them. I had a deal worked out with my professor that I could get up and leave anytime I wanted to and just walk around and come back and sit. So that's when I realized that, you know, if I'm going to a class for 3 hours I really like and I'm having a hard time sitting still, maybe it's time to, you know, get treatment for it. And so that was about, I think I was 23 when I got diagnosed.
So this is, sounds, I was being somewhat facetious when I said, how bad could it be? But it sounds like it's pretty bad.
It can be, yeah. People with ADHD, they not only have a higher rate of anxiety, but they also have a higher rate of depression and suicide as well. You can have even sleep disturbances with ADHD. So it's an all-encompassing disorder. It impacts school, it impacts work, home life, social, just even how you interact with the world around you makes a huge difference.
And so how did that show up for you? Was anxiety and depression, were those problems?
I've always been a little bit of an anxiety person. From reading your book, I kind of understood what you were talking about, you know, that you've had kind of this underlying current of anxiety. So I relate to that. Luckily, I think that kept the ADHD in check, because when you have anxiety, your inhibition in your brain kind of shuts off your impulsivity stuff a little bit. So I think that kind of helped me in check. And again, parents that watch me like a hawk helped too. So it was when I really had to do multitasking and setting up my own study schedule and keeping my own place clean and organized, that's when I started to kind of hit a wall with things. Because I was able to compensate up to a certain point, and then it wasn't covering me anymore.
What impact did the meditation have on you?
What it did is that I noticed, so basically at 23, I got on stimulant medication. I noticed that my medication actually works better when I meditate. So I started meditating probably about a year or two after I started medication. And I've noticed that I'm a hand picker. Like, I pick at my cuticles, and I don't do that anymore. I know you can't see me on camera, but
I can actually.
You can't.
I can see you. Fingers. Yes, yeah. The listeners can't, but for some reason, this is the first time I've done a remote interview where I can actually see you. You can't see me, which is super
cool.
Creepy. But anyway,
nice.
I can see your cuticles from a distance.
So I don't pick at them anymore. I've also found that I am more likely to stop and think about something before I say it. So medication doesn't take care of all your ADHD, you know, because you're still somewhat ADHD. I would say probably it decreases my ADHD by about 60%. So the remaining 40%, you know, that's where I have to kind of monitor and make sure that I'm thinking about something before I do it, or that I'm really focused on driving. And especially, you know, if your medication wears off, then the ADHD kind of comes back with a vengeance sometimes. So I've noticed that when I meditate, I tend to stay more in the present moment, because when you have ADHD, you know that concept of monkey brain in meditation. When you have ADHD, it's like you have super monkey brain. You've got thoughts flying in and out, and meditation makes it so that you only have a few thoughts coming in and out rather than a whole bunch of them at the same time.
But does it make meditation itself harder?
Yeah, it gets tricky. So that's why I usually recommend mindfulness meditation, because when I talk to people about doing, quote unquote standard meditation, the idea for someone with ADHD to sit or lay down, is really kind of difficult for people. So the concept of mindfulness, where you could be walking and meditating or eating and meditating or cooking and meditating, that tends to have more appeal for people. What I've noticed when people do meditation, when they have ADHD, if they can stick through about three 15-minute sessions are pretty good to go, and they'll stick with it a long time. But otherwise, the mindfulness practice has really helped. Again, the idea that you can move around, which is kind of the whole thing with ADHD is that need to move. So mindfulness, again, you know, that kind of caters to that kind of restlessness piece.
So are you able to do extended seated meditation? Is that a part of your daily life?
I tend to do the mindfulness part. I have done seated meditation. It's tricky because, again, you know, if I'm on medication, it's a totally different form of meditation than when I'm off. When I'm on medication, I can sit and meditate the kind of, again, quote unquote standard way for a period of time. Off medication, not so easily. So I can do it for like maybe 5-10 minutes. With the mindfulness practice, I can do that with or without medication. It works pretty well.
Why do you go on and off medication?
So it wears out of your system. So when you take stimulant medication, if you take the long-acting kind, it lasts all day. It usually wears off, like if you take it at 8 a.m., wears off around 3 or 4 p.m. So it doesn't stick with you the whole time. So afterwards, you know, you're still ADHD when your medication wears off. So medication makes it so that your neurons communicate more effectively in the frontal lobe of your brain. So when you're off medication, your neurons kind of go back to business as usual, and it's tricky to really focus on meditation when you don't have medicine in your system. That's been my experience anyway.
I've always been confused as somebody who doesn't have ADHD why you would put somebody on a stimulant, because it seems like ADHD, I mean, H is hyperactivity.
Right, yeah, it kind of doesn't make sense when you think of the term stimulants. Stimulants actually stimulate the neurons to communicate more effectively, so that's where the whole stimulant piece comes in. But yeah, it is kind of an odd name to give something to someone that you want them to calm down. So yeah, it's kind of a misnomer in a lot of ways. But yeah, it helps boost dopamine and norepinephrine in your brain, and when you have ADHD, you're low in those brain chemicals. So it helps get those chemicals back up to kind of where they should be.
You know, I said I don't have ADHD, but I mean, I don't know. I never got tested. I will say that I was a bad student in high school. Definitely have trouble mm-hmm. sitting still to this day. And, you know, when I have a big project like writing a book or writing a big story for Nightline, I work at a standing desk both at home and at the office. I have a lot of trouble, you know, kind of staying focused on things. Mm-hmm. But I don't. You know, people say all the time, it's like kind of a modern trope even, that people say, oh, you know, I'm super ADHD. It's become mm-hmm. a little like almost a throwaway thing that people say to describe themselves. How do you know when somebody actually has it or whether they're just, you know, having trouble focusing on a garden variety level?
Sure, because we all have symptoms of anxiety, depression, ADHD at some point in our lives. But it's when it gets to the point where with ADHD that you're – performance isn't matching your ability. There's a gap in there. So you have 160 IQ, but you got B's and C's at school. You're not working your potential. You really enjoy what you do for a living, but you just can't seem to put it together to write stories on time. Or you find that when you're talking to your spouse that you're not fully listening to them, and it's created conflict at home. So it's where it really impacts quality of life. Again, when there's a gap between what you should be able to do and what you're doing. And if you look at brain function, when you have ADHD, your brain is about two-thirds that of someone without ADHD as far as neural development. And basically what I mean by that is that when you have ADHD, you sometimes are 1 to 3 years younger behavior-wise than your chronological age. So if I'm working with someone that's 20 and in college, it's more like they're 15 or 16 in college.
Wow.
So you may find that sometimes when you're talking with people with ADHD that seems like they're a little bit younger and you can't really kind of figure out why. It may be brain development, so that your neurons just aren't as connected as someone without ADHD. Does that make sense?
To the extent that I'm able to understand anything scientific, yes. Much more of our conversation right after this quick break.
Brought to you by Indeed. Used by over 3 million businesses for hiring. Where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings with screener questions, then sort, review, and communicate with candidates from an online dashboard. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
There's a lot coming at you right now. Turmoil, tweets, an insane amount of chatter.
I'm Brad Milkey with ABC News, and I am here to throw you a lifeline. It's a new podcast called Start Here, where our experts give you on-the-ground access to the biggest stories of the day. We're going to give you some context, some clarity among the chaos. 20 minutes every weekday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and start here.
You work mostly with adults, right?
I do. Yeah, college age on up. Yep.
And how widespread a phenomenon do you think this is? And what about the complaints that we often hear that this is it's overdiagnosed and they're handing out Adderall like candy?
Sure. It's about 4.4% of people in the U.S. So I think that's about 17 million people. And as far as it being overdiagnosed, I get asked that a lot. And it's actually underdiagnosed. There was a study that came out a couple of years ago that said that only 10% of people that think they have symptoms of ADHD, only 10% of them come to see a mental health professional for diagnosis. So that means that, you know, 90% of people with ADHD tend not to get treatment or be diagnosed with it. And it leads to a 6 times higher rate of substance abuse without treatment. Again, leads to higher suicide rate, leads to, this loss of potential, this chronic feeling of, I should be able to do more, but I can't.
And the way, just to amplify the point you were making before, because I suspect a lot of people are listening to this and trying to figure out, like, okay, do I fall in this bucket? The way to really sort of figure out, or one gauge for you is there a big delta, a big gap between what your capacity is and what your performance is?
Right. Like, in school, did you get comments in your report card, like, doesn't work to potential, difficulty staying in seat? Doesn't work to expectations, doesn't complete assignments. Did you go blank when you took tests? Those are some of the things you look for on report cards. When you get into the work field, doesn't complete work tasks, doesn't complete tasks to ability, doesn't follow multi-step directions. Those are some of the things you'll see on performance evaluations that may be a tip-off to ADHD.
So if go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, people on TV news, a lot of them have ADHD because you tend to be gravitated towards jobs that are high pressure, high stress, because people with ADHD do beautifully when it's a crisis situation. It's the day-to-day living. It's the unloading and loading of the dishwasher that drives them crazy. So you'll see people in working in ERs. You'll see people that are firefighters. You'll see people that are salespeople. So you'll see people that really thrive under pressure. So that's another tip off that you might have ADHD is if you really seek that kind of stimulation from your environment.
Right. You said actually after reading my book, you were able to do some sort of diagnosis on me. You said this before we started.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me.
Well, what I picked up on is that first you're in TV news. My undergrad degree is in telecom, so I was going to work at CNN and wound up being a therapist. But I noticed that in the news field, you see a lot of people running around doing stuff, and you have to do things, you know, on a split second. And people with ADHD do beautifully with that. Absolutely amazing. So I've noticed that.
Are you saying that you think I have ADHD?
I would have to evaluate you.
But you would say I would be a candidate for evaluation?
I'd say, yeah, I come down to Tampa and, you know, we can talk. But yeah. And you have a hard time sitting still. And so it's there are some things I picked up on. But it could be, you know, that like I said, you know, you also said you have a kind of a low level of anxiety. So it could be a little bit of that. Could be other stuff that you didn't put in your book. I don't know. But overall, some of the stuff had a flavor of ADHD to it.
Interesting.
But again, we all have those symptoms. But the fact you're in TV news kind of is a little tip off.
Yeah. Yeah, no. My wife is an academic physician, and she has struggled with some of these issues. I don't want to say too much because I don't know how much she wants me to say. But let me just say that she chose for a while to go into intensive care work where she was in the ICU. And a lot of that was about the adrenaline.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I see a lot of people with ADHD working in ICU.
So, when you work with your patients and you say, when you drop the M word, you say, "Hey, I'm gonna recommend you meditate." Do these people who've been dealing with ADHD look at you like you're crazy? Like, there's no way I could ever do that?
I get that from about a third of people. One third of people are like, let me start now. Can I meditate like, you know, in 2 seconds from now? Then I get people that are kind of a little bit quizzical about it. And I get one third of people are like, no way. And interestingly, I get people sometimes ask me, well, isn't this kind of against like my religion? And I'll say, well, do you do any kind of prayer you recite? Because that's meditation. You're already doing it. Anytime that you're zoning out and just hearing yourself breathe, that's meditation.
I would say that's zoning. I would say mm-hmm. It's zoning in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, I like that. I'm going to borrow that now. Can I steal that from
yours?
You?
Absolutely. Totally steal that no from you. Attribution
okay, great.
Necessary.
So, yeah, I noticed that the people have some questions about what exactly it is. And then people that I've worked with will sometimes say, well, I can't even sit still for 2 seconds. And I'll say, no, it's not about the sitting still. It's about the focusing on the inhaling and exhaling. That's it. And people are surprised to know that that's the fundamental process of it, is the inhale and exhale. It's not the laying still, sitting still. And people with ADHD tend to like doing things really well the first time. Like the first time they go to bat, they want to hit a home run. The first time they sit at the piano, they want to play like Mozart. And the first time they meditate, they want to reach nirvana and totally empty their brain. And I'll tell them that there's even people are meditating for years find it impossible to totally empty their brain. That's not the point so much as just focusing on the inhale and exhale.
And then when you get lost, again, starting again.
Yes.
The point exactly. I'm telling this people all the time. The point, yeah, I'm saying this to people all the time. The point is that is not to reach some sort of special state. It is to be in the muck with the craziness of your own mind and to see it clearly without being yanked around by it. Why is that useful? Because in the rest of your life, when your thinking mind offers you up terrible ideas, you're better able to surf them and not be owned by them.
Right. Exactly. And the people I work with, sometimes, again, they're in really high intensity careers and they'll say to me, but if I meditate, won't I lose my edge? Mm-hmm. Won't I not perform as well? And I'll say, no, actually, it increases it. It increases your ability to do your job effectively. And that's really kind of mind blowing to them that you can do meditation and still be able to function at your job and actually perform better than you did before.
Yeah. People think they're not going to be go, go, go. They're not going to be ambitious, aggressive in the and not in the pejorative.
Right.
But actually, when you stop wasting energy on useless distractions or useless mm-hmm. anger and being yanked around by your emotions and you're better able to stay on task, et cetera, that is all a massive value add in terms of your professional mm-hmm. goals.
Right. People think they're getting kind of when they meditate, they're getting a smaller piece of the pie. Like they're kind of shortening their skills. And in fact, I'm like, well, no, it makes a bigger pie. You know, it makes a bigger amount of brain space that you can use to do what you want to do. And again, yeah, you're not thinking too far in the past or too far in the future. You're thinking of just here and now, and your productivity increases a tremendous amount when you're really in the stuff you're in. When you focus on what you're doing, you completely 100% focus, it's amazing how much more you can channel into your work. You access parts of your brain, I would argue, not in a scientific sense, but you access parts of your brain that you wouldn't have otherwise. You put more of your, I guess, your heart and soul into your work, and that makes a huge difference. And you know, just doing that one thing can change everything.
So you work with college age on up, but do you don't do any work with kids whatsoever?
I do too. Yeah, I work with kids up to teenagers too. Yeah.
And what do you say to parents who are really worried about their kids with ADHD, and how seriously should they be taking mm-hmm. the option of meditation for kids in this context? Does that work?
Yes, it does. Actually, there's quite a bit of research out about teenagers and kids practicing meditation and mindfulness meditation that it actually can do some brain structure differences. It improves the connections in the prefrontal cortex. It's been found to decrease an inflammatory agent in the body. So there's all sorts of things that when you start at an earlier age, you get more of the benefits over time. And studies have found, again, just with kids, you know, just like with adults, it improves symptoms of ADHD, anxiety, and depression.
So how do you get them to do it, though?
Well, we start out really small. So I teach kids how to do inhale and exhale. And the way I describe it is you inhale like you're sniffing a flower and you exhale like you're blowing out candles on a birthday cake. And so we practice. And sometimes I'll have the kids lay on the ground. And I'll put a stuffed animal on their tummy and we'll practice diaphragmatic breathing. So when they inhale, the stuffed animal goes up. And when they exhale, the stuffed animal goes down. So they have a visual of when they're doing deep breathing, that diaphragmatic breathing. That's so important. So, and also I'll use a bubble wand for real little ones to teach them how to do exhale. I'll have them exhale, blow out through the bubble wand for a count of five. And again, they may not understand the concept of counting to five, but they know visually how long 5 minutes are by using the bubble wand. So a lot of neat visual cues you can use.
I like that. I have a three-year-old that could work with him.
Just a personal story. I recently finished writing a book with a co-author, this amazing meditation teacher from Canada named Jeff Warren, and he has the first thing we did was before we started writing was we took a cross-country road trip, and the goal of the trip was to meet people who want to meditate and to help them get over the various obstacles they faced to starting a practice. And so we went across the country in this big orange bus, and I really got to know Jeff very well. And during that time, he repeatedly referenced the fact that he had ADHD and had struggled with it since he was a kid. And maybe it's because we live in a culture where people describe themselves as ADHD all the time. I didn't really take it seriously. Plus, he's such an amazing meditation teacher. It didn't land, let's just say. But then when we started the writing process, it really landed. And I thought ADHD meant that you just can't pay attention to anything. And as you said before, there's a whole kind of range of flavors of it. For him, it's not that he can't pay attention. It's that he gets overly focused and goes into these rabbit holes we'd be writing this book. I'm like, hey, man, this is a book for beginners and skeptics. And he would want to talk about like deep end Buddhist esoterica. And he was getting all excited. And the book would be a failure if we didn't talk about what blah, blah, blah. And I would be wanting to like throw myself out a window, like, because I really respect him. And we almost killed each other over this. And it was just over and over again. I would point out that he just, built this treehouse in his mind and climbed up into it and lived in it for a while. And he would eventually recognize that, yes, he had done that. And then 10 minutes later, he'd be back in another treehouse. And so it was an incredibly challenging thing for me to deal with. Never mind how hard it was for him, of course. Any thoughts on all the stuff I just blurted out?
Sure. Yeah. People with ADHD don't think in a linear fashion. They don't go A, B, C, D. They go A, R, Q, 2. They go all over the place. And if you don't have ADHD, it can be really hard to track that kind of thought process, and especially when you're doing some kind of structured project. So for people with ADHD, it really helps to get parameters put in place. So for instance, like chapter one, okay, we're going to knock out chapter one by, next Tuesday. Okay. Chapter two, I need you to do an outline for me by, Wednesday. So it really helps to give people parameters that they can work under, because it's very difficult for people with ADHD to come up with their own parameters, their own rules for working. Does that make sense?
It's so funny you say that, because that actually ended up being the solution. When I imposed structure on him, he was able to do really well. And in his defense, the non-linearity of his thinking is big part of his strength, that he is a brilliant guy and able to connect ideas that heretofore have been disconnected. And he's unbelievably creative and energetic. So there are lots of upsides to his condition.
Right. And you're able to channel that into productivity. So that was a great idea to give him those parameters.
Yeah, well, it was not a great idea. It was born out of utter desperation. I didn't know what to do.
Still a great idea.
but I think a lot of people don't know that ADHD can manifest in many different ways.
Yes, and hyper-focusing is one of them. So people will sometimes get into a meditative state and nothing will tear them away from it. They could have a fire alarm going off and they don't hear it. So that's one of those things about the regulation of the brain, is that hyper-focus is just as much a symptom as lack of focus. And so the hyperfocus actually can be helpful with when doing meditation, because you can kind of channel yourself into it. But the trick is with ADHD is you have to want to do it to get hyperfocused.
Right. Right.
You have to have that motivation to do it. And motivation is the part that's off in ADHD. So it's kind of a catch 22. You know, you want to do it, but you can't always motivate yourself to do it.
So tell me about some of the books you've written on this subject.
Sure. Yeah. I've written a book on non-medication treatments for ADHD. It's called Natural Relief for Adult ADHD, Treatments to be Used with or Without Medication. That has a whole chapter on meditation, mindfulness, talking about the research behind it, user-friendly ways to do this. Because again, you're talking about the esoterica part of it. And I think that sometimes people, it needs to be broken down to language we can all understand, and easy to do techniques. Like again, just focusing on your breathing, you know, inhale for 5, exhale for 10. And that's a practice of meditation. So another book's 10 Simple Solutions to Adult ADD, and I write about meditation, jobs that are ADHD friendly, setting up structured schedule, how to communicate effectively with your spouse or partner, because that gets to be a big issue too, you know, higher rate of divorce in people with ADHD. So also a book on making the grade with ADD, that's on college and ADHD, so chapter on mindfulness and meditation in that, and also talking about, again, how do you set up your structured schedule? You know, in high school, you know where you're supposed to be 7 hours out of the day, and your parents get called as soon as you don't show up for class. So now you're in college, and nobody's reminding you to wake up for class. Nobody's telling you when to study, and that's when a lot of people with ADHD kind of hit the wall. Their compensation techniques and that parameter that was put on them no longer exists, and it gets really tricky for people to function.
In your daily life, being exposed to so many other people with the same condition, is that useful or a challenge for you in terms of managing your own condition?
I find it actually helpful because I think I can meet people where they're at a little bit better. Again, being on medication helps, but I think also I can understand that nonlinear thinking process and also help people channel it. I think that's one of the biggest parts. Like you were saying, the parameters you put on your co-author, again, you know, how do we set those parameters? Because your brain doesn't want to go in those parameters. So how can you set up these kind of blinders, sort of horse blinders, to stay on the track of completing your work? So that's a lot of what I do, is help people get that structure in place and then get effective treatment. And again, one of those effective non-medication treatments is meditation. I mean, medication overall, according to research, is the most effective treatment, but meditation does have a lot of data behind it as one of the most effective non-medication treatments.
But in that answer, you talked about how having ADHD can help you be a better therapist. I just wonder, like, mm-hmm. being exposed to all of the pathologies, mm-hmm. given that you're also dealing with your own, does it make the challenges mm-hmm. greater for you? Because this is still an issue in your life.
Sure. Yeah. I found that it actually enriches parts of my life because I can see I love working with people, and I can see their journey through life and their progression, and that to me kind of it makes me appreciate life more, I think, because I see the different paths people have gone on and some of the adversity people have gone through. So I think it actually enhances my life rather than makes the ADHD kind of worse. So I don't.
Yeah,
does that
no,
make
that
sense?
Makes. Yeah, it does. It
okay.
does.
Okay.
What in terms of the challenges you continue to face as a result of having ADHD? What are the most prominent ones now?
Let's see. Showing up on time.
Really?
So I showed up at the studio a half hour early. So what happens
today
with ADHD is you wind up. Yeah. Oh yeah, I was here early. So what you do is you kind of overcompensate for stuff. I'll show up kind of super early for things. And again, medication makes it so that I'm more likely to stay on time, because you actually do more time estimation correctly when you're on medication. So, but yeah, I'll show up early for stuff, or, my friends just know that I'm going to be running a little late for things. So part of it is just saying to people, hey, I run a little late. Yeah, it doesn't matter what time I leave, I'm going to run a little late. So that's one of the things I notice. Also, I lose stuff all the time. I have those little tile trackers. I have them on everything I own. So I should probably get stock in tile, because I have like 8 tile things, so I can find everything wherever it is. I have GPS trackers. I also, again, meditation, first thing in the morning, do that. There's a mindful driving. So I focus on the steering wheel, feels in my hands. I focus on cues on the road. holding a thought and thinking about it before I say it. Much easier to get on medication. Without medication, you got to really make a concerted effort to think about what you're saying and if what you're saying is actually what you mean to say. One of the trickiest parts of ADHD is what you're thinking and what comes out of your mouth can be two different things. So that gets tricky too. You have to monitor a little more. So I would say that's probably the biggest things I notice. And also, again, I have kind of a healthy dose of anxiety, so it kind of keeps the ADHD a little bit more at bay, I think, than people that don't have anxiety with ADHD.
If I could wave a wand right now and quote-unquote cure your ADHD, would you want me to do it, or would you say that actually the benefits outweigh the costs?
You know, that's tough because there are some things that I really like I tend to be pretty creative, and I tend to like doing a bunch of different varied tasks or, you want to go on a trip somewhere? Sure, why not? I don't think ahead about that stuff. But the parts about getting to places on time, that would be kind of nice. So if I could do kind of like a half and half, like if I could just improve the stuff that, I'd like to improve and then keep the stuff I like. So I'm going to answer that with, some things and not other things, just to make things more complicated.
Yeah, I don't have that kind of wand. I only have the wand that's... So this has been great. I've learned a ton. Are there questions that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
No, I think it's really important to let people know, though, that meditation is accessible to everyone. Again, it's a really high return on your investment. You don't need to spend any money to do it. You can do it anywhere. You don't necessarily need someone teaching how to do it. And the benefits of it are, according to research and just my anecdotal evidence, is that it's very effective. So, again, it's one of those treatments that for what you put into it, you get a lot more out of it.
And if people want to follow you, do you have a website or a social media that you do?
Yeah, it's stephaniesarkis.com, so stephaniesarkis.com. That's also my Twitter handle. I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, Stephanie Sarkis. And also there's a contact page on my website. If anybody has any questions for me, I'm happy to answer those.
This has been super useful. I really appreciate your time and your good humor and your punctuality.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohen, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at ABC News Podcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.